Yes, my name's Chad, Senate Chair Johnson, and House Chair Kuminga, and honorable members of the Marine Resource Committee. My name's Chad Coffin. I'm here on behalf of the Friends of the Clammers, and also I'm the president of the Maine Clammers Association. I'm on the Freeport Shellfish Commission, and I've been a clam digger for my entire adult life. And so anyways, I appreciated the opportunity to come meet with you guys. I know there's some new faces on Marine Resources, and more importantly, we'll get right to it. The shellfish industry overview. I attached some landings to this PowerPoint presentation I put together, and the economic impact is still right around. We estimate, according to Kevin Athern of University of Maine Machias, it's somewhere in the $50 to $70 million economic impact. I think we had around $10 or $12, $13 million worth of landings. I apologize for not having the exact details on that, but the industry is still comprised primarily of municipal shellfish commissions. And one thing I would like to add that I didn't add to this, and I actually thought of it, and I'd like to apologize to the Commissioner Kelleher for not including it, is that we have seen the industry. I think that one of the most important things to report to you today is that we have seen, we've experienced a great change at the Department of Marine Resources in the last couple of years, especially the last year, and in the Public Health Division. And, it's really incredible what's happened. I never would have dreamed it would have taken place, but especially at the level that it has, but it has, and people are very, the flats that can be open in this state are pretty much open right now. And so they've done a tremendous job. I know people at DMR have, employees have gone the extra mile and taken the stuff home with them. And I just think that, it all starts with the commissioner. And like I said, I apologize for not including that, but, that is the case, and you guys should hear that. So that being said, again, we're still very reliant on healthy ecosystems and water quality, and like I said, we're still, again, things have improved greatly. That's another issue. DMR has been much more proactive when it comes to pollution, and it's not just a matter of closing the area and forgetting about it, and there's nothing we can do. They've actually, gone the extra mile in a lot in all over the coast. So anyways, but one of the main reasons that I wanted to come up here today is that in my experience in the Freeport Shellfish Committee, I've been fortunate to have the support of my town, and they've thrown money behind our committee to try and diversify species, because our concern was, we read in the newspaper where people, where towns are putting in new zoning ordinances and trying to address the potential sea level rise in coastal communities. And one thing that brought our attention to the fact that the shellfish community or the shellfish industry in Maine really didn't have any plan to deal with that potential impact. Like I said, we haven't really seen, I haven't seen any personally on the flats. The tide still goes out to where it used to, at least to my knowledge. Maybe it isn't out quite as far, but anyways, what we did was, in this process, we determined that we really wanted to start enhancing the stocks of native subtidal shellfish species so that we could, over the course of the next couple of decades, start building up these resources so that in the event that the sea levels do in fact rise, making a lot of the intertidal zone that we now know, subtidal, very shallow subtidal, that we'd have some, that we could, basically transition the industry smoothly. That was the plan anyways. So anyways, within this, throughout this process, we got into, we were ready to go. We've got money. We still have the money. And, we're ready to rock, but we ran into this crab issue. And it's very significant. And it's much bigger, I think, than most people realize, especially the science community. because one thing we started doing was we started piecing, you know, throughout this process, we started piecing together the whys of a lot of things that we maybe thought we understood before. And, for example, I mean, I can go in, you know, go into some of the details as to, you know, why this has happened, but one thing that was interesting is that a lot of the stuff that we thought was cutting edge on our end, it's turned out this it's already been done before, and as far as research. And to the DMR's credit, back in the 50s and 60s, and also to credit a person I'd never met, his name is Dana Wallace. He worked for the Department of Marine Resources for a long time. I never met the man, but the stuff that I've read and the research that he completed was incredible. And this actual green crab phenomenon or explosion, population explosion, actually took place in the 1950s when we experienced a weather pattern or you know, a climate very similar to what we've experienced these last 10 years. And you know, so we've really learned a lot about what the impacts of climate change, and these crabs are probably, you know, these are the number one threat to every resource in the marine resource environment that we know of. We don't, you know, there may be other diseases and stuff we haven't encountered, but from what we've learned about these crabs, they are, you know, they're destroying Maine's coastal resources. And it's no one's fault. You know, I mean, it's you know, like I said, it's just the more we've researched. I mean, the research is extensive. I didn't attach all the paperwork to the studies that have been done. You know, Canada has been spending a tremendous amount of money on studying the green crab lobster interactions, shellfish interactions. There's tons of stuff out there. It's incredible the research that was done in the 50s. I mean, they've gone as far as to study the stomach contents of green crabs and count the individual clams in them and you know, fencing, trapping, all kinds of stuff's been researched. So we have the good thing is we have a wealth of information. The problem is that we really haven't, as an industry or as a state, we really haven't addressed this problem. We've basically ignored it. And I don't know. I think a lot of it is that once we've learned the impact that weather has on these creatures, these invasive species, is that, you know, we've had weather patterns, and as we all know, weather fluctuates. So we get, you know, we get a cold spell, we get a couple of cold years. Well, we've since realized that actually knocks their population back considerably, and so a lot of resources that, you know, we were using haven't been predated yet until recently in the shellfish resources. And like I said, for one example that I put in this bullet, I mean, the shellfish harvesters that I work with are now referring to all marine species as menu items. They're no longer, you know, what we refer to as, you know, we don't call lobsters, you know, lobsters on the menu. You know, green crabs, scallops, clams, quahogs, those are menu items is what they are for this creature, and they're eating them all. They're eating everything. And so anyways, you know, like I said, we're seeing huge, huge changes in the ecosystems. Huge. I mean, it's immeasurable, the changes we're seeing. We're seeing at the Coastal Conservation Association banquet supper on Thursday night, they, on their PowerPoint, they had data that supported a 90% decline in striped bass populations in the last 10 years. You know, that's a pretty big decline in striped bass. Why? You know, I don't know if that's related necessarily to green crabs, but we do know that green crabs are eating the eggs of most of the shallow forage fish species. We know this. It's well documented. They're eating the babies of everything that's in the shallow subtidal and intertidal zone. We've seen, you know, most stuff, you know, I've grown up around the ocean, around fishermen, and, you know, I actually am guilty of blaming a lot of stuff on overfishing. Because that's, you know, it's kind of what you grow up, you're in school, you read that in the newspaper all the time, you know, overfishing, it's overfish. Those guys, they overfish everything. Well, the reality is, it looks, you know, from the research we've done, it now looks like that fishing has a very small or minimal impact on many of the resources that we value. You know, without green crab predation, there are more clams than we have people to dig them. You know, that's what we experienced after. The lucky thing for us back in the 50s was we went into the 1960s, which is referred to scientifically by many scientists as the mini ice age. That actually knocked crab populations back to the point of, even in my lifetime, in 1989 when I started clamming, there was a lot of clams in what we call now referred to as the outer and mid-inner tidal gradients, which is basically the flats are broken up into three sections scientifically. It's the intertidal gradient is broken down into the outer, mid, and upper intertidal gradients. And what we've seen statewide is a complete disappearance of the outer and mid intertidal shellfish resources. They're completely gone. This summer, green crabs were so thick in Casco Bay that we, you know, there's a law that actually it may have been on the books longer than we even realized, you know, as far as the shellfishermen go. But one law that we had some trouble with compliance on was we're not allowed to leave clams overnight from the night tide until the morning tide because it's wet storage. It's technically wet storage. The federal rules prohibit that practice. We, you know, that was one of the big beefs. Oddly enough, you know, it's absurd, actually, now knowing what we know now, that was one of the big problems brought to us by shell fishermen is this ridiculous rule that we can't leave our clams overnight on the flats. Well, that's no longer a big issue in Casco Bay because, you know, you can't leave clams overnight anymore because there's nothing left in the morning when you come back. You know, that's the level of predation we're seeing. It's incredible. So anyways, I can go through the list of menu items if you'd like, but I think one of the most significant ones that I would like to mention, though, is the mussels. And I didn't attach this. I got this from Allison Soroy yesterday at DMR because I remembered her talking about the fact that she mentioned that the Red Tide program relies on mussels for its monitoring program. That's because mussels process a tremendous amount of water. They process 59 times more water per day than a soft-shell clam. So they're able to pick up the red tide or different bacteria or planktons, whatever. And that's one of the critical assessment or monitoring tools that we have. And they now are importing the mussels from other parts of the coast because there aren't any mussels in Casco Bay. You know, and like I said, we're talking about an immeasurable resource has disappeared. We saw it disappearing, the fishermen did, back in the early, the 1990s, in the 2000s. Again, blamed on mussel draggers. You know, you go to the DML website, you can actually read where mussel draggers disturbed and destroyed 137 acres of eelgrass habitat in McQuaid Bay, in Casco Bay, back in the 1980s and 90s, dragging for mussels. But I can tell you, historically, that I worked on the mussel boats when I was in high school. Me and other kids used to go down to the Harrisseek at Lunch and Lobster and shovel mussels on the boats. We got a buck a bushel. And, those guys didn't have enough market. We only could go a couple days a week. The mussels went away long before, you know, the mussels disappeared way before anyone got a chance to drag them all. And that doesn't explain why the draggers don't drag, at least in Casco Bay, they never dragged intertidal mussel resources, which carpeted at least 50% of the intertidal zone. There isn't a mussel out there. Nothing. And like I said, what we've realized is, according to Dana Wallace, this gentleman, Dana Wallace, God rest his soul, you know, the stuff we've read, you know, he documented in 1999 that water temperatures for the 1990s had exceeded 48.5 degrees Fahrenheit, which is the threshold for, above the threshold for green crab proliferation that they saw in the 50s. So while we were happily digging clams, clams were plentiful everywhere, but the mussel resource disappeared first. Well, now the outer and inner tidal shell clam resources are gone, and there isn't any spat that we know of. There's one spat location that we know of, and from a survey, we've been conducting numerous surveys. We haven't found any spat in Casco Bay. There's one sample site that I know of that had spat in Brunswick. So we know this year we basically had zero survival of, you know, juvenile shellfish recruitment. Zero. That's none. That means, you know, we're literally a few years away, not just in Freeport, but in all along the coast. We're getting this from Machias Port, Lubeck, Hartswell, West Bath, Waldoboro, Thomaston. These are the areas. You know, these Scarborough, it's the same thing everywhere. The seed is being eaten before our very eyes. And like I said, the more we've looked into it, again, these things thrive on, they prefer shellfish. So they eat scallops. They voraciously eat scallops. They eat anything with shellfish. They eat lobster. We know they eat lobster. One of the studies that Commissioner Kelleher handed me in a recent meeting even indicated in this one abstract trial that green crabs outcompeted lobster 63 out of 65 times for food and shelter. And we're also seeing a huge, we have a bay in Freeport now in Brunswick, McQuaid Bay, where you don't fish for lobster anymore. It used to be a prime fishing ground. It's no longer that way. It's full of green crabs. There's nothing up there but green crabs. Trapfuls, millions of green crabs. So that's the kind of stuff we're seeing out there on the ocean. And that's why, you know, like I said, I wanted to come up here and talk to you guys and at least let you know what was happening, because we're not addressing, you know, the real issue. We're trying to manage the carnage that's left, and it's going to be, it appears now, it's going to get worse and worse. And so anyways, but, you know, like I said, supper time, I'm learning things every single day about this stuff. One thing I've learned recently is that it starts in the water column. I kind of pee of a brain or my, you know, my logical side of my brain would say, geez, you know, they must have to, you know, these plants must have to settle, then they start eating them. Well, apparently that's not the case. They actually release their eggs. They start feeding on all the zooplankton in the water column, and then that's what grows them big enough to sink to the bottom. And then they take off and go after all the everything they can get their hands on. So that's really when supper time begins, and that's why, you know, I put the supper time note on the presentation. But you know, and like I said, I hate it. You know, I one thing I've learned dealing, and especially in my relationship with a lot of you guys, is, you know, don't always, you know, just don't come up here and you know, complain and say, we got this huge problem, you know, we need solutions, you know what I mean? You know, everyone's got a problem. You know, but what can we do about this stuff, you know what I mean? And that's a good question because, you know, I mean, you know, like I said, with Commissioner Kelleher, I mean, I don't think, you know, I mean, it's like, you know, when we talked about it, I mean, this is a fairly, I mean, we've known about it, but I don't think he or any, it's not his fault. How could anyone really know how bad it really is and how bad it's getting? So, you know, and he too was like, you know, well, what can we do? And I haven't got, in all fairness to him, I haven't got back to him because, to be honest with you, you know, it's a difficult question. What we're going to do about green crab predation and what we're going to, and why it's just, you know, and how it's destroying everything that we value, everything. And, you know, because, and the other thing is, you know, I put another note in here, about mussels, you know, we keep hearing all this. Everyone's talking about ocean acidification. That's what everybody in the marine resource scientific world, anyways, that's what they want to talk about now. Ocean acidification. We've got the oceans are acidifying. Well, that may be true, but, you know, in Maine, we've learned that our acidification issues are much different than they are out in the West Coast. Out there, they have an upwelling issue. I don't really fully understand it, but I know that it's a much different issue than ours. In Maine, the preliminary research conducted by Friends of Casco Bay indicates that ocean acidification is directly related to nitrogen runoff and high carbon. That's what they're finding at these sites. But, you know, it leads us to believe, as a clammer and as somebody, you know, that, you know, Clint grew up on the flats with me, and, you know, it's you have to think, you know, if a mussel processes 59 times more water per day and we had approximately 200 square miles of 6-inch deep mussel resource and it's literally gone, you know, does that affect the ocean's ability or to process nutrient runoff? You know, does that have an impact on ocean acidification? You know, I agree. We're seeing, I forwarded you guys some emails. I apologize. I didn't have a chance to print it. But eider populations, you know, just in the last 10 years, we've seen eider bag limits decrease from 7 to 5. Now it's 4. They're decreasing. All the studies show eider numbers are plummeting along the coast. Why? Well, they eat mussels. That's their primary food source. That may have something to do with it. You know, I don't know that for sure, but I'm just, you know, these are the kind of things that we're seeing. And like I said, and the more we've looked into it, like I said, we know that this is a huge, huge problem. Again, getting now, like I said, I don't want to take up all your time, so I know you guys have, you know, got other people to talk to, but just to present. But, you know, what can we do? So what are the solutions? And that's why I'd like to introduce Commissioner Kelleher to the podium. No, just kidding you. Like I said, we don't really know either. But things that these are the things that we've been talking about, and these are the things that we've been finding out. And one thing that we would like to that we think we don't know what the general feedback is. There's nothing we can do. Fishermen won't do anything to help themselves. They're too stupid. They're too lazy. They're too stingy. They're too self-absorbed. They won't lift a finger unless they're paid to help themselves. That's the general consensus we get from almost everywhere we go, even the fishermen themselves. So that's a big problem. But we still refuse to accept that fact. And we feel that we should launch explore launching some sort of educational initiative that educates people, fishermen, to the real destructiveness of these creatures. It's ridiculous for a lobsterman or a clammer or anybody for that matter to encounter a green crab and let it go free and release it. That's what happens. We have a great friend of ours in Lubeck, Ricky Wright, scallop dragger. The drags come up full of green crabs. They shovel them over the side. You know, we need to educate these people that this is probably not a good practice, that we need to kill these things need to be destroyed. You know, there are some logistical problems with this. You know, we put just a minimal amount of traps. So not just us; it's been done in Penobscot. Where else? There's other places along the coast. This year, 180 crabs came out of the Waldoboro River. 180 crates of crabs 3 years ago came out of the Waldoboro River, and a friend of Adams trapped them out of there. So you know, these things are. The resource is incredible. What do you do with 180 crates of green crabs? You know, we hear, everyone says, oh, you need a market. You've got to have a market for these things. We can't do anything until let's develop an industry, a market. Well, you know, well, one thing is, there's two things. One, we can't wait for a market. Two, it's difficult for us to comprehend developing some sort of market or resource, you know, or a business based on something that you want to eradicate. You know, so that kind of question, and actually, Commissioner Kelleher actually, thankfully, brought that to our attention. You know, that's probably not the direction you want to be going in. You know, or you want, at least want to think of, there's stuff to think about. There's ramifications to everything we do. But anyways, that being said, getting back to what we can do now, again, we need to do something to educate fishermen to the severity of what this problem is. And that's all the stakeholders, and that's everybody. These things eat eels, they eat elvers, they eat everything. They eat everything. The babies of everything we value, they eat it. You know, incentives. You know, I did talk to Patrice McLaren of MLA just the other day on the phone, and, you know, I asked her to think about this. As something, like I said, I'm not bringing everything to you and handing, you know, the solutions, but, you know, we need to explore creating incentives for marine resource uses to catch and destroy green crabs? Is there anything we can do to give them an incentive besides saving themselves, which apparently isn't good enough? Is there anything we can do?
My price for it is fertilizer.
You know, regional shellfish collaboration is something the Maine Clammers Association is working on now with Dan Devereaux of the Brunswick Marine Patrol. We need to increase information sharing, because we've also discovered that there are methods, proven methods, that can in fact limit green crab predation on intertidal shellfish resources. They're very labor intensive. There's a lot of maintenance. It's not really something that we relish getting into. But that being said, there's still going to be a lot of activities taking place out on the flats, I would assume, in 2013 by at least a few communities. I don't want to say a bunch, but I know there are communities that are going to be exploring fencing, trapping, stuff of that nature, netting, stuff like that. So we need to develop a system that will, you know, work. Actually, one thing that came to mind when I was sitting in the chair there was, you know, the area biologists. You know, they have 78 meetings. You know, a potential for information sharing exists with this division. So we need to do a better job of sharing information with other municipal shellfish programs that are interested in trying to preserve and enhance shellfish resources. Another key to this thing is preservation and biomass protection. We're very concerned, deeply concerned, with the small strip of clams now along the shores in the state, that we're not going to have a lot of spat in the water column, a lot of biomass, and that once we may have already reached critical point. We don't know, but we know we're dangerously low on clams, spawning clams. We call it the salt shaker theory. That came from Dr. Brian Beal. Essentially, you know, we want to make sure that there's the areas of the coast. For example, the New Meadows is a critical. We've identified that as a potential critical shellfish spat resource area region. You know, we know that all clams come from the east. We know this through the extensive studies that have been done. That clams generally float about in the water column for 2 weeks, and in the summer, the tides and the currents are the same. And pretty much, they've been the same every year for hundreds of years. I don't know hundreds of years, but that's the general. They haven't changed for a long, long time. You know, so there may be different fluctuations. Some years you may get a different variation of a cove or a wind current or something like that. But overall, we do know that all clams come from the eastern direction in the state of Maine. So clams that are in your town, you know, there's a pretty good chance, a very high probability, they don't come from the town you live in. So that means if Freeport goes out and does all this work and traps all these crabs and does all this great job, it doesn't mean squat, because the people above us to the east, if they don't do anything, we don't get the salt. We don't get the spat. So that's a big key to preserving the shellfish resources of the state, is going to be continuing to identify different areas. We feel that salt ponds actually, the more we learn about them, that they actually have a huge impact when it comes to seeding the state. So those are areas that we need to look at protecting. One thing that we're doing in Freeport, on the regional level, is we're throwing money. We're actually going to take one of the scarcest resources we have, money, and we're going to arm the New Meadows salt pond quahog rakers with crab traps. And it does appear that through research that you can actually protect salt ponds from crabs, because it's a very small, limited entry point of entry, and most of them have quite small habitats to begin with. So, you know, these are the types of things. It's just an example of some stuff that we're doing. We're going to be exploring, and we hope to be moving ahead very soon. Research and development, you know, it's a frustrating thing when you read the list of research projects that go on in this state with regard to natural resources, research and funding, development. You know, we really could care less about a tropical fish or, you know, or some other bizarre species that takes money out of the Maine Economic Improvement Fund when we know we have shellfish resource, or not just shellfish resources, excuse me, marine resource menu items that are being depleted to unprecedented levels. I found it odd, and I don't like to contradict, because I actually love Patrice, and I think she does an unbelievable job at MLA, but I think it's a stretch to say that the lobster catch is not resource-driven. Something's driving the lobster catch. It isn't that they've done an unbelievable job managing the resource. That's not why there's 123 million pounds being caught. You know, that's about the only thing left down there. You know, I don't really know for sure, but like I said, we're quite convinced that we think the lobster population will provide a pretty good resource for the green crabs when they run out of clams in the next 2 years. You know, so, I mean, that's the kind of things we're talking about. So they're on the menu. Then it's well documented what they eat. So, again, like I said, and also the one thing I forgot on the menu item is eelgrass. And, you know, they've been documented to cause eelgrass destruction. So there's a lot of different aspects, environmental, ecological aspects to this creature that basically have been ignored. I haven't really seen anything in a reference to green crabs in any management plan of anything. All I see is regulating fishermen, blaming them, hoping that reducing their effort will make it better, make them come back. We hope that winters get bad. We hope that the ice comes back. Well, you know, we can't hope anymore. You know, we need to do something about these green crabs. So that's why I drove up here today, because I wanted to tell you guys all this stuff we've learned. But
it wasn't just to cheer us up.
No, it wasn't just to cheer you up. But these are the kind of things that, you know, that we've discovered. And like I said, it is deeply troubling. So anyways, that's it. Do you have any questions?
Thank you, Chad. Yes, Representative Weaver.
You saw some landings over here of the clams.
Yep.
The crabs, is there a market for them?
The markets we've discovered, they're very limited. There are some bait markets. There's also some food markets for green crabs.
Well, then how do you kill it? Say you have 100,000 crabs. How do you kill them?
Well, you just dig a hole and bury them is what I'm assuming.
You're going to bury these babies alive?
Well, hopefully compost them in the hole. Yeah. But I'm not really sure. That's what I'm saying. There are logistical questions that we haven't answered. You know, what are we going to do with all these things? We have a place, Freeport's lined up. We have a facility right across our border that's licensed, that's ready to take 3,500 pounds a day, but that's nothing. That's literally nothing when considering the resource that the amount, the population of this invasive species.
Representative Kamigan.
They would be taking them to compost them?
They're going to bury them. That's what they were planning on doing with, because they do have quite an odor. After they die after 2 or 3 weeks in the sun, these things are tough. They live in the sun for a week in extreme temperatures. They can survive sub-zero. They're very resilient. You know, in fact, it's very common now for the clam buyers to have to go through the clams to get the green crabs out when the guys dump them, because they jump in the bags while we're washing them up. You can't leave a bag, you know, for 5 minutes in an incoming tide. You know, they're covered in green crabs. I mean, it's incredible, and the flats look like a moonscape from the pockmarks. I mean, you can tell we have a flat in Freeport. I have a picture, and I will make a point of forwarding this out. I did show Pat the picture, but there's a state closed area in Freeport, Sandy Beach, and there's a line that goes right down the middle of this cove. And you can't tell from one side to the other on whether it's clam digs or crab digs. The crabs have dug the clams right to the shore. You can, I mean, it's it's incredible. I mean, they just
The memo.
Right. They didn't get the memo. They're eating everything. There's almost, you know, like I said, and this is, again, I'll repeat it one last time, and this is all over the coast. It's not just, you know, the only, and one thing we've learned, looking at the last 30 years of shellfish landings, the only towns that have really produced significant landings consistently are the ones that get ice, the river systems that have gotten ice, like St. George, and the Madomic freezes up. It's one of the earliest rivers to freeze. That's one of the reasons they always are up, you know, no matter what they do. They sell a ton of licenses, but they still get 1 million pounds every year, or close to. They get ice down there. The towns that are on the more subtidal areas, those areas, those landings disappeared 20 to 30 years ago. And nobody cared. That's what strikes me about the lobster industry is that it'd be very difficult to convince a lobsterman in Stonington that there's a green crab issue when he's catching, you know, trapfuls of lobster. You know, but ask a guy in Casco Bay that fished McQuaid Bay or Wolf's Neck or over towards Yarmouth in the Cousins River area. I mean, they might tell it, they might sing a different story. It's the same thing with the clamors. We've, you know, just by being broken up down the coast in all these different communities, you know, a town will go offline. They won't, their landings will collapse, and we'll say, oh, geez, you know, these guys are they're dummies. They don't manage their flats. You know, that's why their clams are gone. But to the reality is, you know, this is why. They're closer to the subtitle.
Thank you.